Hey, it's Mark. We're showing up midweek to bring you a bonus episode, a short conversation with Edgar Villanueva, a nationally recognized expert on social justice philanthropy. Edgar grew up in North Carolina and is an enrolled member of the Lumbee tribe. He's the author of Decolonizing Wealth, a book that proposes indigenous solutions to dysfunction and inequality in philanthropy and finance. Among other roles, he serves as chair of the Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy and is a board member of the Anders Family Fund, a national foundation that works to improve outcomes for vulnerable youth. Crosscut's editor-at-large Knut Berger asks the questions. This conversation was recorded at the KCTS 9 studios in Seattle on November 19, 2019, as part of the Crosscut Talks Live series. Oh, and Edgar refers a few times to the panel discussion that this conversation was part of. When he says Nikita, he means Nikita Oliver, an artist, attorney, and organizer in Seattle, well known for co-founding the Seattle People's Party and running for mayor in 2017.
Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, I just want to ask you, what does decolonizing wealth, what does that look like?
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here. You know, for decolonizing can mean a lot of things. It's becoming a buzzword. Politically speaking, decolonizing, or quite literally, means to give land back to whom it was stolen from, to return and restore all rights and sovereignty to folks, indigenous folks. And I think for me, as a Native American, I'm an enrolled member of the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina. I think of decolonizing a little bit different because I'm from a community that was the first point of contact 500 years ago for colonization in this country. And so we have quite assimilated in many, many ways, and have our businesses are intertwined with descendants of settlers. Our families are. So for me, decolonizing is something I think about through the lens of truth and reconciliation. It's one, acknowledging the harm and trauma that has happened in communities as a result of colonization, as a result of white supremacy, coming to terms with that and grappling with that truth, and then engaging in a process of healing. So personally, that's a process that I've been engaged in. It's something my community is deeply engaged in, and it's something that we as a country can engage in.
But you're going to meet a lot of resistance to that, right? There are a lot of white people that don't want to face any of that. They don't want to hear the history that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, in this country, I think we have a fascination with the new and shiny, the innovative. We're very futuristic. And we, unlike many other, you know, quote-unquote civilized societies, have not had a process of truth and reconciliation. We haven't grappled with our original sin of slavery. We don't even teach the truth in our public schools about what happened and what has transpired in our history as a country. In fact, this month is November, Native American Heritage Month, and the president of this country he was the first president in 30 years who did not put out a proclamation to even celebrate Native history, Native resilience, and in fact put out a new proclamation that going forward, November would be America's Founders Month. And so there's an intentional erasure of indigenous people and native folks in this country, in part because we do not want to grapple with what has transpired. You know, on one hand, it's kind of easy to understand as a human being that if there's a pain or a trauma, we might be inclined to avoid that and to not want to deal with that or sweep it under the rug. But the reality is the fact that we haven't grappled with that truth, that is festering under the surface of our communities. We are all being harmed. We're all experiencing a trauma from that, including white people.
You know, one of the things that's been true in Seattle for certainly the last century, actually more, is there's this yin-yang conflict. And one part of it is socialists progressives, mainly socialists, and labor on one side, very strong forces in our history. And on the other side, we have a knack for creating billionaires in recent years. And it's been this fight between the Chamber of Commerce and labor and social activism. And they're both realities in this city. And we have Jeff Bezos and we have Nikita Oliver in the same city.
How fortunate you guys are. You're lucky to have her.
And, so I'm kind of curious, working through nonprofits where a lot of corporations attempt to do good or appear to do good, what are the kinds of things that they should be doing, and what are the kinds of things nonprofits should be doing in order to balance the scales a little bit better, if not a lot better?
Yeah, so, I work and live inside of an industry with a lot of contradictions, a lot of both and kind of situations. Philanthropy often has this, there's this idea that we are the do-gooders and we are the good guys, right? And over in corporate America, those are the bad guys. The truth is that philanthropy and charity in this country, this $900 billion industry, is a byproduct of capitalism and of corporate America. And so a lot of the work I've been doing as someone that's working inside that industry trying to disrupt is actually just naming that, right? Let's be honest about what it is, right? That we are actually inherently, we exist as an industry in this country because of capitalism and corporate America. And in many ways, we as an industry that is supposed to be charitable often perpetuate the same type of harm on communities that corporate America may also cause. You can clap if you want for that. And so a lot of this is just really naming things for what they really are and being honest about it, because we often just get caught up in the romanticized view of life and we can't disrupt and if we don't name it, right? And so I appreciate white supremacy being named tonight on the stage, because that's what we have to name to disrupt. But within philanthropy, this $900 billion industry, you have to understand these are wealthy folks and corporations that got a big tax write-off for starting a foundation. No one got less rich because they started a foundation. In fact, the next year they were wealthier, right? And so we applaud and put these folks on pedestals for starting foundations. And now I don't want to take away from the fact that it's very generous and it's nice, right? It's not a bad thing to do it. We live in a country that has a legal system where it's permissible to start a foundation. Most wealthy people don't give at all, right? So I'm not going to attack wealthy folks for actually giving, but we do have to examine the democraticness, if that's a word that I'll make up, of it all when wealthy folks and corporations can start foundations that are tax exempt and then call the shots for how those resources are deployed that have huge impacts on our lives every day, versus putting that money into a tax system that we, the people, actually can call the shots on how those resources are used for our families and communities.
I know you've done some advising and talking to people at the Gates Foundation, at Amazon. I don't know what your non-disclosure agreements are like, but I'm wondering if you could give us a general sense of what you tell them.
Yeah, I will say here in the debates tonight and just knowing right now in our country we are super, super polarized, I will say over the past year I have had conversations with folks outside my bubble. And I also was raised in the South. I come from a very right-wing conservative family. I've always straddled these strange spaces and had to be sort of the peacemaker in some ways. I will say that within a lot of these other industries, within corporate America, within these large philanthropic organizations, there are good people working there who are trying to disrupt from inside the belly of the beast. So I have had to pull back on my biases of demonizing everyone who is, you know, perhaps working in another place, right? And really subscribe to the idea of emergent strategy. There are people who are trying to change things, and there is a role for business that's appropriate as a part of our society. What I say to these folks is the same thing that I say to foundations, is to hold up the mirror and examine your history, right? What have you done that's been helpful for community, and where have you screwed community over? And be honest about that and grieve that and actually apologize, right? Apologize for the harm that you have caused, and then enact policies and change the rules so that you don't continue to harm folks, right? And examine how you can show up as a better citizen or resident of the community, like pay taxes, right? I pay taxes. You should pay taxes, right? So it's really acknowledging the full picture of how we show up as a corporation, as a foundation, and taking ownership of where we have not done right by community, and pay reparations, like fix it, help work to repair it.
I've got one last question, and then we're going to go to questions that the audience has submitted. And that is, I read it's something that you wrote, that indigenous values have influenced your values and ought to be more widely appreciated. And especially since we are on indigenous land here, I wondered if you could tell us what some of those values are that we need to learn from and embrace.
Yeah, some of them Nikita referred to, one that is really core to me. It's understanding that we are inherently connected to each other and to this planet, right? All my relations. And so what has happened as a byproduct of colonization is that we all subscribe to being separated. We build walls, we separate from each other, we don't know how to build relationships, and we make decisions every day that we think have no consequences on other folks or on this planet. And we have a separation-based economy. The only reason there are kids locked up in cages, south of here, is because there are folks who made those decisions who don't feel any connection to those kids. If they were our kids, we would be raising hell about it, right? And so an indigenous worldview is believing that we are all connected, and every decision that we make impacts another person and impacts the planet. And so I think if we could subscribe to that at some level, we would all make better decisions, right? And this is where the tough part, is for me, because I am Native. These are my values. This is what I've been taught. But we're taught to actually care for folks and see folks as our relatives, even if they don't agree with us. Now, that's hard for me, right? I'm colonized to the extent where that part of the Native belief has been a hard pill for me to swallow. But I've really tried to practice that recently as our country is so torn apart and, we are subscribing to different ideologies. And I'm constantly confronted when I'm visiting relatives and other places to see if I can get to a place to see the humanity in folks and extend some level of grace and understanding and see them as my relative, even if I don't disagree with their politics, right? Now, I'm not saying that I water down or I compromise or I accept, folks who are deliberately trying to wipe out my community, right? But it is getting to a place where I do see people and have extend a lifeline into their humanity and into my own humanity to say, well, you know what? We both have pain at some level. Can we talk about that and get to some type of conversation about healing?
Well, thank you very much. Let's hear it for Edgar.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Rusty Bacall and Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.